This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. On Monday, the World Health Organization launched the first World Antibiotic Awareness Week. The whole idea behind the campaign is to help the public and even health workers and government agencies to better understand how we end up with bacteria that cannot be treated with even our strongest available drugs. It turns out a lot of people might not even understand what antibiotic resistance is. And how can you confront something that you don't understand? We're here to talk us through the confusion surrounding antibiotic resistance, as well as other selected short subjects in science, is Ed Yong. He's a science writer for The Atlantic, based in London. Welcome back, Ed.
Hi, Ira. Good to be here.
Let's talk about what you discussed. What are some of the misconceptions surrounding antibiotic resistance?
Well, so the Wellcome Trust, a British charity, did this survey with these focus groups, and they found that people just don't understand how antibiotics work. They assume that they need antibiotics when they are very sick, so it's the severity of the illness that matters. It doesn't matter whether they have a bacterial illness, which these drugs might work for, or a viral illness, which they almost certainly won't do. It's how bad they feel. And this problem of bacteria becoming stronger and being able to resist our drugs, people just don't understand that at all. When you talk to them about antibiotic resistance, they assume that it's the people, it's them who are becoming resistant to the drugs, not the bacteria. And it's such an intuitive idea, isn't it, that you take a substance and your body becomes tolerant of it. But it leads them to very bad decisions because they think, okay, if I don't take the full course of antibiotics, I'm not going to build up this tolerance. I'm not going to become resistant. So I should stop. And then actually, ironically, that means they're more likely to accrue a drug-resistant infection.
So maybe you have to rebrand it somehow. Give it another name.
Well, so the Wellcome Trust have stopped saying antibiotic resistance altogether. They've just simply flipped the word order and they're talking about drug-resistant infections or antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And they're talking about specific things like MRSA, MRSA, or E. coli. Mm. They're showing people pictures of these microbes so that they can really sort of get a sense of what the enemy is. You're foregrounding the bacteria as the things that matter, not this abstract concept of resistance.
Let's also talk about something you're working on, that kids around the world, do they have the same or a similar idea of what fairness is?
Right. So this is really interesting. There's people in general care about fair play and we care about equality. But it turns out that the way we learn about that differs from country to country and depending on age and the type of fairness. So this study of seven societies around the world found that everywhere kids care about getting less than their peers. So if you give like one kid one piece of candy and another kid four, the kid with one will say no one should get any candy, even if they stand to lose their one piece. But the flip side of that is that only kids in some countries care about getting more than their peers. So if they stand to get more candy, it's only ones in the USA, Canada, and Uganda that cared about that, whereas people in, say, India, Peru, Mexico, and Senegal didn't mind. And this aversion to an advantage to getting more than your peers only happened at a much later age. So it suggests that these types of reactions to fairness really are very different and that they're very subject to social and cultural norms.
Wow, that's quite interesting. Also, it sounds like you've got some more bad news for bees, a common pesticides affecting their ability to pollinate.
I do. It's a bit of a buzzkill, I'm sorry.
So to speak.
The world's most popular insecticides are called neonicotinoids or neonics, and they affect all the tissues of the plants in which they're used. They spread everywhere, including nectar and pollen, where they can be exposed to bees and other pollinators. And many studies over the last few years have shown that bees are affected by sublethal doses, so doses that don't kill them but can affect their behavior, the health, and the viability of their colonies. And this latest study shows that that has trickle-on effects to the plants they pollinate. The bees become more incompetent pollinators, and the plants produce, in this case, apple trees, produce fruits with fewer seeds in them. And this matters because it's estimated that something like 1 in 3 bites of food that we eat come from plants that are pollinated by bees, and something like 7 in 8 species of flowering plants rely on bees and other insects to pollinate them. So the fact that these very widespread insecticides are affecting the quality of pollination services that bees and probably other insects are delivering is a cause of concern.
Is that because of the possible health effects of the pesticides?
So it's not clear. So the pesticides affect the nervous system of insects. So you could understand how, say, by affecting their ability to remember where they've been and to find their way home, it changes their ability to act as effective pollinators. Whether these insecticides have any health effects for humans or not is unclear. But I think by affecting the health of bees, they're indirectly affecting our health by changing these the behavior of these incredibly important pollinators.
Absolutely. And last but not least, you bring us a quirky story about a mollusk with a shell that's kind of an eyeful.
That's right. Very good. So chitons are a group of little-known mollusks. They're related to snails and octopuses and clams. They look a little bit like imagine a woodlouse with like a skirt, like a fringe around it. The chitons are covered in these hard shells, these armor plates, but the plates have eyes in them. They have hundreds of tiny little black eyes embedded in the plates. And what's really astonishing, this has been known for like the better part of a century, but what's really astonishing is that in the last few years, scientists have shown that the lenses on the eyes are made of aragonite, which is a type of limestone. So these are animals that are seeing the world through eyes that have rock, that are made of rock. And the latest study on chitin eyes asks, why are there so many? Why so many tiny little eyes? Like if each eye was much bigger, these animals could see much crisper, sharper resolution images. And they think it's because the eyes are embedded in the armor. Now, if the eyes were bigger, they would create weaknesses in the chitin's shell, which would make it more vulnerable. So the shells with the armor, because they has to provide a compromise between vision and defense, mm-hmm. ends up with this setup with lots of tiny, low-resolution eyes.
As they say, nature will find a way. Thank you, Ed.
It will indeed.
Yeah, Ed Young, science writer for The Atlantic, based in London. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And with the Internet of Things Wi-Fi-ing all of our intelligent gadgets to the web, it was only a matter of time until our toys got the digital treatment, too. So get ready this holiday season to say hello to Hello Barbie. This Barbie 2.0 from Mattel and the San Francisco-based toy company, Toy Walk, is a Wi-Fi-enabled, artificially intelligent chatterbox. She has more than 8,000 lines of dialogue. Barbie can ask you what your favorite color is and even get you pumped up about science, like she does in this video from CNET.
The study of physics is incredible. Take gravity. You can't see it, but the second you trip, it's right there to pull you down.
There you go. Okay. Enough hyping. Hello, Barbie. Now for the tough question. Is this a good way for kids to play? Joining me to talk about the good and bad of this artificial intelligent doll is a journalist who took an extensive look at Hello Barbie's development. James Vlahos is a contributor to New York Times Magazine and Popular Science, based in Berkeley, California. Welcome to the program, James.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the good thing about this Barbie.
So the good thing is this Barbie is allowing kids to achieve a timeless dream with toys, which is kids have always talked to their toys, whether it's a doll or a train or whatever it is, And this finally is a doll that actually talks back. And not only does it talk back, the conversation is all pre-scripted by a creative team that's led by two former very high up technologists from Pixar. So it's kind of like having the special sauce of the Pixar animation studio inside the brain of your little Barbie, you know, being able to talk to Buzz Lightyear, and Buzz Lightyear talks back, only it's Barbie. So they've come up with all these conversations that a kid can have with a doll, from kind of obvious stuff like favorite colors and fashion and pets, to less obvious ones, like science, as you point out, careers, even discussions about feelings. So it's quite a technological feat.
Yeah, so what could be the bad news about this?
Well, probably the headline on that, and certainly the thing that has made this doll somewhat controversial, are privacy concerns. There was a Wi-Fi doll, was and is a Wi-Fi-enabled doll in England called My Friend Kayla, that hackers were able to get into and get the doll to say rather dirty and inappropriate things for children. And so people here are concerned that the same thing possibly could happen with Hello Barbie. They're also concerned that just as part of this process, when you are playing with your Hello Barbie, you talk to Hello Barbie, there's a microphone, there's a Wi-Fi transmitter, it goes out over the internet, goes to the servers of Toy Talk in San Francisco. And those little conversations with kids, some of them are actually stored. And Toy Talk does this so they can figure out what content is working, what's not working, and improve it. And they also do it so they can work on the speech analytics, because the voices of kids are among the hardest for a computer to decipher. So that's why they do it, but it certainly has some parents and a consumer group concerned, hey, you're storing, like, you know, you're eavesdropping on my kid and you're storing it. What's going to happen with this?
Well, if we've seen Hello Barbie, is there a doll that's up, Ken? You know, something like that in the works?
You know, I'm sure if this is a success as a product, more will follow.
And maybe even ones you can program yourself someday. Put your own stuff in there, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, what's interesting about this doll, they've got 8,000 lines of dialogue already written for Hello Barbie, but there's no limit. They can keep writing more and more, and they can write more dialogue based on what kids seem to want to talk about with the doll.
Yeah.
So her little brain can grow. And the other thing, I mean,
well, I got to go. So we'll talk more about it maybe after the holidays. See how it worked out. James Vlahos, contributor to the New York Times Magazine of Popular Science. We're going to take a break. Come back. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Let's say you apply for a new job. Would you rather have your resume judged by a person or an algorithm, a software, computer? The fact is, you may have no choice. If you've applied for a job at a big company recently, chances are you may have already been subjected to this trial by machine. And in theory, that should be a good thing, right? Take the human out of the equation, all the bias, the baggage, the discrimination. Be judged purely on your merits. But it turns out that machines resemble the human makers much more than we might have imagined. My next guest says that if our algorithms are fed data from a flawed, a prejudiced world, they can end up with many of the same biases that we do. Kate Crawford is a principal researcher at Microsoft Research, visiting professor at the MIT Center for Civic Media. Welcome to Science Friday.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks, Ira.
And we want to ask our listeners, if we want to hear from them, would they rather be judged by a human or an algorithm? Has an algorithm ever discriminated against you, to your knowledge? So give us a call, 844-724-8255. Also, you can tweet us at SciFry. Kate, there is a lot of hype about the power of big data. Why, in your view, do we have to treat the data and what machines are doing with it with a bit more skeptical eye?
Well, big data is very exciting for lots of reasons. It gives us capacities that we simply didn't have before. But there's also this little trap that we can tend to look at large collections of data as somehow being more objective and more representative, when this is not necessarily the case. And and we can make the same sort of miscalculation, if you will, about algorithms, that because they're systematic, we assume that they're somehow more objective than humans. But what we're starting to see is that we can have elements of bias in both the data sets that we're using using and in the algorithms themselves.
Give us an idea. What kind of real-life examples?
Sure. Well, I first started researching this several years ago now when I was looking at the way that we use social media data to understand natural disasters. Mm-hmm. And what you find if you're using, say, for example, Twitter data, is that in many cases, Twitter tends to be used by people who have a little bit more money, often a smartphone, often they're urban, often they skew younger. So if we're starting to use that data to really try to understand where to direct resources in a natural disaster, you're missing part of the picture. Then I started to look at how apps might be reproducing this form of bias. So there's an app that's actually quite fascinating called Street Bump, which is used in the Cambridge area. Now, this was designed for really good reasons. It's actually very smart. What it does is it basically tracks your accelerometer and your GPS data as you're traveling down the road. Mm-hmm. So when you hit a bump, it'll say, oh, there's a bump. And if a few other people hit the same bump, then the city knows to send out a road crew and repair that pothole.
Yeah.
Absolutely right. But what I started to do is to look at who owns smartphones in the Boston area. And what, unsurprisingly enough, it tends to map with people with more disposable income and also younger audiences. Particularly if you look at the over 65s, you'll find that in some cases, smartphone penetration is as low as 16%. So what you end up doing is having an app which in many cases is accentuating the signals from areas that have younger, wealthier residents. And we're not getting the signals from areas of where we have people who have less money or if they're generally older populations. Mm-hmm. So what that can mean is cities could start to be resourced and repaired based on signals that are really skewing the population towards those who are already a pretty privileged base. So I started to think about both how the data collection can produce particular kinds of, shall we say, black holes, and mm-hmm. really boosting the signal of populations who are already, let's face it, very well connected.
So if you were to look at that example, and you say, how, knowing that the data could be biased, how do I unbias it? Maybe then you put the detectors on garbage trucks that go everywhere.
And that's exactly right. And that's actually exactly what they did. And the group, the New Urban Mechanics, who built this app, are actually very sensitive to making sure that this data is equitable and they're getting a good picture of the city. So what they did is they put this app along all kind of council vehicles, from garbage trucks through to, you know, to police cars, so that they get a wider signal. That was a really good example of a quick response and thinking about how you try to unbias your data. But in many cases, that's a lot harder to do, particularly if you're using historical data.
Now, you know, everybody, the first thing they do when they want to know something is that they Google it. Are we getting biased data coming back from a Google search?
Well, it's really interesting. So a group of CMU researchers recently published a paper looking at what happens if you Google for particular jobs. And they actually created a very clever system that was automated, and they created a lot of fake profiles, half of which were female and half of which were male. And they used this to test what kind of job ads they were being shown. And very problematically, what they found was that all of the really high-paying jobs, the CEO-level jobs, the things that were 200,000K plus, were being shown far more to men, and they weren't being shown to women. So that produces a very serious bias that, of course, impacts upon itself, because not only do we have a problem with not enough women in the C-suite, now they're not even seeing the ads for those positions. Mm-hmm. So absolutely, we've seen particular forms of search bias across all of the search engines. And this is something, obviously, that's very serious for technology companies to think about.
I want to bring in another guest. Suresh Venkatasubramanian is an associate professor in the School of Computing at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. He joins us from KUER there today. Welcome to Science Friday, Suresh.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about, before we get ahead of ourselves too much, let's get into the nitty-gritty about the software itself, which at its heart contains these algorithms. What actually is an algorithm? You had a great article in Medium comparing algorithms to recipes. Let's talk about that.
Sure. So one of the things we do in our undergraduate and classes in computer science is to teach people what it means for something to be an algorithm. And the usual story we tell them goes something like this, that you should think of an algorithm as a set of instructions that take some inputs and produce some outputs. And the best way to think about this is like a recipe. So you have a recipe for making something. It has a set of instructions that are hopefully well-defined and easy to follow. Not always, but most of the time. And your inputs are the ingredients, and the output, hopefully, is the food you want to make. And so we've been telling this story for a long time, and I think it's a very good story. It captures a vast majority of the kinds of algorithms we work with. But what it does not do anymore is capture the kinds of machine learning algorithms that we're actually using in the cases that Kate mentioned. And by the way, Kate, I'm honored to meet you. I loved your article on the 6 provocations for big data, by the way.
Oh, that's very kind. So, thanks, Suresh.
The better analogy and what I wrote about in the article was something a bit more involved. That looks something like this, if you permit me to sort of tell a little story. So Thanksgiving is coming up, and you know we're all going to be making, among other things, stuffing. And you could, of course, get a stuffing recipe from a book and make it. Mm-hmm. But let's suppose you didn't do it that way. You didn't use the algorithm for making stuffing that way. You did something different. What you did was you called 10 of your friends over to your house 3 days before Thanksgiving and said, bring me your examples of stuffing that you like, and if you can, bring me an example of stuffing you don't like. So they come and bring the examples, and they leave their bowls there marked off with what they like and don't like, and they go away. And you taste the different stuffings, and you have some idea, okay, I need these ingredients. I need maybe, you know, I don't know, breadcrumbs, or I need cornmeal, or I need celery. And you make something. And you make something, and they come back the next day and tell you what they liked and didn't like. And you do this over and over again. Eventually, you come up with a set of instructions that might involve, you know, mixing the ingredients in a bowl, twirling 3 times on 1 foot, spinning it over your head. And it works great. You write these instructions down very faithfully, and you send it out to everyone and say, these are the instructions for making stuffing. And they make the stuffing, and it works. And if they come and ask you, well, why do I have to twirl 3 times? Your answer is, I don't know. It just seemed to work. And now, if you did this in Salt Lake, you might get one recipe. You did this in New York City, you might get a different recipe. They will all be recipes for stuffing, but they're all very different. They all come from different sources. And it's very hard to tell why they are the way they are. And that's what these algorithms are nowadays. That's exactly how they look.
Mm-hmm. Does that explain how the algorithms get written? Is the software actually writing its own algorithm then, if it's different in every city?
Essentially, yes.
Wow.
They are being trained. So the algorithm takes in some data. It trains itself on some data. It has what I was describing. It plays a game of 50-dimensional roulette, essentially, trying to find a spot to land in a very, very high-dimensional space. And it lands somewhere, and where it lands is the final algorithm.
Wow. That's so many things. So how does that mean? So that's how then it might filter down to a resume, because we're feeding in all these biases of our own, all the different recipes, and that pops something that we don't recognize or we don't really want?
Yes, and one of the problems is that humans are very good at trying to find patterns in data. Machines are also very good at trying to find patterns in data, whether or not they're meaningful. Mm. So if finding a pattern gives you some edge in terms of, you know, prediction accuracy or how well you can match the results that the human told you should match, the stuffing that your friends told you was good, for example,
right,
you will find these small patterns. So an algorithm that scans resumes might even say, oh, I noticed that this, you know, when people use this kind of font, it has a high correlation with being productive. So we should, you know, this is an important feature. Is it or is it? I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. But it could do things like that. And it's hard to understand why it's doing that.
And Kate, and big companies are doing resume scanning like this now?
Absolutely. I mean, this is really common at the moment. And I think the big problem is that, as Suresh points out, there can be, frankly, just errors in how they're understanding what productivity looks like. I mean, in many ways, we could think about the process of being hired as always having an algorithm. You met somebody who would look at your CV, they would decide what a productive person looks like and acts like and talks like. It's just that now those algorithms are basically within systems that in many cases are black box, so you really don't see how you're being judged. Mm-hmm. And that's actually part of the problem. I mean, I like this idea of the cooking analogy, because I think one of my favorite descriptions of how we can think about these kinds of big scale data systems comes from Jeff Bowker, who said that raw data is both an oxymoron and a bad idea, that in fact, you know, your data should be cooked with care.
Yeah.
And in many of these cases, these are systems where, you know, the data is being cooked, but we don't know necessarily the level of care that's being brought to it.
Like that. I'm going to go to the phones. Back in the day when I was studying computers, it was garbage in, garbage out. Let's go to Todd in Oakland, California. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So I work at Google, and a while ago I built a hiring algorithm that did a pretty good job at predicting who would be successful. So I thought I would just weigh in a bit.
I'd love to hear what kind of criteria you're using to determine what success looks like there.
And what algorithm you're using.
Yeah. So I can't give away the secret algorithm, but I can say that we looked at both, were you successful in getting hired, but also once you got hired, we looked at 30 different performance metrics, from performance scores to organizational systems, ship behaviors, to all sorts of different performance metrics to see, once you're there, are you a good performer?
And what were some of the unexpected findings in terms of things that would make somebody likely to stick around?
So we thought going in that GPA would be an important variable, but what we found was it's only important for the first 3 years after somebody graduates, and then after that, it loses all its predictive power. So we kind of changed what we were looking for to, once you've been out of school for 3 years, we don't really look at your GPA.
So what was the most successful predictor?
You know, a really interesting one was the age you got into computers compared to your peers. And we didn't ask you what the absolute age was. We just asked compared to your peers. So if you're 50 and you're getting into computers and all your friends don't get into it for another 10 years, you actually get in younger. And that actually tended to correlate really well with success on the job.
Let me just remind everybody I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking
so
about
I had a question for Todd, actually.
Go ahead. I know you're chomping at the bit, Suresh. Go ahead.
Sorry. I was just wondering, what kind of training data did you use?
We used everybody that had come through our systems for, I think, about a year, and then looked at their performance data a couple years later.
Okay.
Did you have to change anything, or you now have a fully cooked, because we're using a recipe analogy here, do you have a fully cooked method now?
Well, I agree with the other two callers that it's used as input in the hiring process, and we get a lot of pieces of information, and we don't ever just turn to the algorithm and say, who do you want to hire? But it's better at combining some of the pieces that we do have, and then we still turn it back to the humans to decide who should we hire.
Can I ask a little question about where you might think bias could emerge in a system like this? And I'm thinking, for example, about gender bias, which is obviously a very big issue in the technology sector, and we're trying to increase the number of female engineers and programmers, but it's still at a very low level. I'm thinking about the fact that quite often boys are encouraged to get into computers earlier than girls for a whole range of reasons. Do you think that might also skew that particular marker that you have that says, you know, age that you get interested in computers relative to your peers? Do you think that might then have some sort of gender flow-on effects in terms of who's being seen as a hireable candidate?
Well, it's actually not something we ask about when we hire for people. It's just what it shows is interest in technology, and that was one way in the validation study that we asked it. But when people come in and do interviews, we ask everybody all sorts of different questions that just gets into, are you curious about technology? Mm-hmm. So it didn't just have to be, when did you buy your first computer, but, you know, did you take apart your phone at home and, you know, other ways you got into technology?
How do you address jobs that are not technological? Teaching, welding, anything like that? Or are you just talking about technological jobs?
Well, for us, we're more interested in that because we hire technologists, but I think what we're looking for is a passion in the subject matter that you're being hired for. So if you're hiring welders, you might say, what age did you get interested in, you know, welding mm-hmm. stuff together or paper hangers or different things? It's just kind of passion for the thing that you're being hired for.
So one of the interesting things that comes up in this, and I'm not implying that this is directly affecting the algorithm that you guys are using at Google, is that, you know, even if you don't look at attributes like gender or race, it's well known that it's easy to essentially pick up on correlated attributes that could give you this information effectively. And in fact, one of the things that we've been looking at in our research is, you know, if you know, how can you tell, can you make some assessment of the potential for bias by discovering these correlations? For example, if you're not looking for gender, but if you're looking at things like when you first got into computing, as Kate mentioned, if there's a disparity in when boys and girls first start getting into computing, it's quite conceivable that with some collection of attributes, you could essentially predict a gender attribute that the algorithm might effectively be doing, even if you're not explicitly asking it to do so.
Exactly.
And I'm wondering if you've ever investigated any possibilities for things like that.
Well, I mean, so the comparison group was peer group, so that's kind of one of them. So if your peers were fellow girls and you still got in younger, that would help. But I think the larger point is that we look, we ask when people apply to us for a whole ton of different pieces of information. Work samples, they come in an interview, they code while they're there, and all these are different signals. And then at the end of the day, we still are asking a hiring committee, a group of peers, to look at all the pieces of information and still decide.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for calling us, Todd, and don't be a stranger.
All right, thanks.
Have a good holiday. Interesting people listening to Science Friday. All right, we're going to come back, take a short break, and come back and talk lots more about hiring and maybe see if you'd rather have a computer or a person do your interview, job interview. I don't know. Maybe it doesn't matter anymore. We'll talk about it. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In case you joined us, you've joined us into a good hour. We're talking this hour about algorithms and prejudice hidden in computer code with Kate Crawford, principal researcher at Microsoft Research, visiting professor at MIT Center for Civic Media. Suresh Venkatasubramanian, he's an associate professor in School of Computing in the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. Our number, 844-724-8255, lots of discussion. Okay, let me ask you, let's say a company found that its algorithms were indeed discriminating against job applicants, but it saves a ton of money to use machines and wants to stay with the machines. Is there any incentive for the company to change this, any way for it to do that?
Well, this is a big risk right now, that there just simply isn't, in some cases, enough incentive for them to stop. If it's really saving them that much money and they get a few error cases here and there, it's tempting to stay with the system. And this is part of the reason that, certainly in my work, one of the things I've been calling for is, how do we have due process with big data systems? And due process is an idea that's been around since the Magna Carta. We've had it since, 1215. But when it comes to big data systems, what does due process look like? And at the very least, I think it has to begin with letting people know that they are being judged by these large algorithmically driven systems. And it also should allow people to see the data that's being used about them and, in some cases, correct the record. If it's bad data, we all know that there are many systems that have just incorrect data about us. Taking that browser test, which predicts how old you are and what gender you are, and I quite frequently come up as a 29-year-old male. I think that says something more about my music taste than possibly my film taste. We know that incorrect data is out there. So how do we let people know that they're being judged by systems and that they can actually intervene? I think that's really important.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Michaela in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
So I work at the Writing Center at my my college. I'm a college senior, and as a person, I feel like there's very much a formula for writing a resume. There's words you're supposed to use and not use, and I hate the idea of a computer weeding through that even more, because as a person, we work so hard on these resumes, and like that's all they see us as is this piece of paper. So my method is kind of to try to use the same words that are going to get you through, but have a different voice, something that's going to catch the person who's reading it, catch their attention. But if it's a computer, can they pick up on a voice? Can they really get more of who you are?
It's a great question. And in some cases, there are interesting ways that you can write algorithms to look for unusual turns of phrase. But perhaps what's more interesting here is that you are being judged for things that you're probably not even thinking about in your resume, like, for example, your address. So there was one HR firm that has been using an algorithmically driven system that gives people extra credit if they live within a close radius of the workplace, if they're sort of within a 15-minute commute, because their data showed that if you had a longer commute, you were more likely to quit or to be fired within a year, which basically means that the investment for them is being lost. So what that also means is that they just start to hire people who live nearby, which can have a whole range of other discriminatory functions, particularly if you're in an area where it's expensive to live there. You're then immediately tending to hire people who have more money and more access to urban areas. So there's a lot of questions that we might ask about how that sort of resume scanning works. But keep in mind that even when you're trying to find that beautiful turn of phrase, they might just be looking at your address, and then that's actually a real problem in terms of discrimination.
Suresh, you have a comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, another example I've heard of is where the system will scan the layout of the various text blocks on the page and use that because of some pattern they found, that people layout blocks in certain ways has a better is a better resume and is a better, more likelihood of someone being a good employee than if they lay it out in some other fashion. It sounds ludicrous, but again, this is one of the things that there's such a vast choice of patterns that a machine can pick up on. It's not just the text and it's not just the words you use. But having said that, you know, there are algorithms that, yes, for example, in music, there are algorithms that claim they can pick up on tone, they can pick up on characterization. So I think there's a lot of work on trying to pick up on things like tone. And of course, you know, can you tell someone's gender from the text they use and the words they use? This is something that's been around for a long time. So there are lots of things you can do with that.
Is there any research that shows that you get a better interview by a person or by a computer, your chances? And should you request to be interviewed by a person if you're going for a job?
I'm yet to see this get down to the interview stage, I have to say, Ira. I think at this point there's still humans at that interface, but it's the back end that I'm more worried about.
I mean, could you ask then your resume to be looked at by a person than a computer?
In fact, there are companies that are offering the following service, where rather than go in for an interview, you sit down with Skype and talk to a machine. It sends you questions, you answer, they record the video, they analyze the video, they create a bunch of features and a bunch of estimators, and then give it to a human.
See, I'm ahead of my time.
You are. Look at that.
this is happening now, yes.
Wow. But beyond picking up a job or a loan application, are algorithms being used by law enforcement in many ways that actually...
So everywhere. So I just came back from a workshop that Data and Society ran in D.C. on data and civil rights, and it was all about use of data in various stages of the criminal justice pipeline, going from predictive policing to sentencing guidelines to parole guidelines, you know, recidivism rate estimation. It's being used all over the place. And that's, I think, in some ways, an even more serious and consequential use of algorithms than in hiring. Not that hiring is less important, but and there's a lot of work being done. It's being pushed all over the place, and there's a lot of questions about the effectiveness and the value and the ethical use of these methods.
Yeah. Well, and now with terrorism attacks, are we going to see more algorithms being used? Do you suspect, Suresh?
Are being used. Yeah. I don't think they're already being used all over the place. I don't think there's a question of more. There's a lot that's happening that we don't know about, and there is definitely a lot of profiling that's happening, you know, inside at that level. I mean, the NSA has a gigantic facility out here in Utah, among other things. So yes, I think they are going to be doing a lot more of it, and that's exactly the problem. I think that. The thing is this, right? And going back to the example with the caller from Google in many ways, and what he describes, is doing the right thing. They have a number of different features. They have a number of different predictors. And the hope is that if you put enough of these things together, that you hope. And again, you hope that biases might cancel out. Again, you don't know, but you hope so. The problem is, and as Kate mentioned, you know, when you have bad data, right? You have incorrect data. There was this horrific story I heard a couple of years ago on This American Life about someone whose name was similar to another known terrorist and was put into an FBI watch list. And 15 years later, even though the FBI had cleared him as being uninvolved with any activities, could not get his name off the watch list. And that bit that was set with his name was propagating into credit applications and loans and things like that. And he just couldn't get it out of there. And so, what Kate is saying makes perfect sense. You need a way to verify in some ways where the data is being used for you is accurate in any form.
Okay.
And this is a big problem, I think.
I think that's absolutely right, Suresh. And I'm really interested in what we do about it, because I'm concerned about the kind of discrimination we're seeing against entire groups, be they African American, be they women, be they people who live in rural areas, you name it. We're seeing a form of group discrimination often occur in these kinds of systems. But there are things we can do about it. I think one of the things we've been discussing today is, you know, how do you have sort of internal systems that are checking for discriminatory outcomes. A lot of technology companies are looking into that. Another thing you can do is external audits. Can we actually really test, you know, who's getting a loan from this company? Who's getting housing from this company? You know, who's getting jobs over here? And that's another way to look at it. But perhaps the thing that I think is most exciting to me right now that I think we can do pretty much immediately is to really think about this concept of data ethics. How do we train data scientists to be thinking about these questions of discrimination and fairness when they're in school, when they're actually learning how to use these techniques? It's actually very powerful to think about these questions in an educational setting so that when you're out in the world designing these systems, these are the first questions you ask yourself. Yeah. Because as we know, I mean, these systems do encode forms of human blindness and sometimes human bias. And if we're if we're basically just thinking about, you know, who is affected by this system and who might I not be including, that can actually be very powerful.
All right.
And I'd like to go further than that even. I think along with the education that is incredibly important, and I've been educated myself just by looking at this, we have to look at the algorithms very carefully. Some of the research that, you know, that I and others and many of us have been looking at is how do you instrument the algorithms to do exactly what Kate's asking, detect potential for bias and even try to repair bias. There actually are ways now where you can take a black box algorithm that someone's using and modify the data that's going into it to essentially remove signals that could be potentially discriminatory. Now, there are a lot of technical details in how this works, but this is some of the research that I've been doing, and there are ways, we're still very early in the early days of doing this research, but there are ways we can do this, and essentially we're trying to formulate a mathematical way of describing bias and describing how to be fair, how algorithms could be fair, and trying to implement that into algorithms. So there are lots of things we can do, and I think we need a lot more study of this, and there is more growing interest in the technical side of things and how to do this.
And we'll be following this. I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us today. Suresh Venkata Subramanian is associate professor in the School of Computing at the University of Utah in Salt Lake. Kate Crawford, principal researcher at Microsoft Research and visiting professor at the MIT Center for Civic Media. Thank you both.
Thank you, Ira.
And have a happy holiday season to you. Speaking of the holidays, one of the staples of the fall holiday season is cider, apple cider. Perhaps it's going to be served at your Thanksgiving meal. We're going to talk about cider science, but not the hot drink with that little cinnamon and stick floating in it. Nah, we're going to talk about the good stuff, hard cider. SciFry's web producer Chow Tu visited a facility in upstate New York, a place where cider house rules, and she's here to share her experience. Welcome, Chow.
Hi, Ira.
Tell us about, you went to visit the Nine Pin Cidery up there, right, near Albany.
Yep, Albany.
What's it like inside?
It's a huge warehouse. So Luke Roskin, who's our video producer, and I went up there. And so we walked inside, and we were just overwhelmed by the smell of sweet apples and alcohol. And so inside, there were these three big vats, and inside the cider was fermenting. And so we can smell it. We can hear it. You can hear the carbon dioxide kind of escaping as it was fermenting.
Yeah. You know, we all know that beer and wine are fermented. How is cider fermented differently?
So cider making is very similar to winemaking. They both come from fruits, start from fruits. In the case of cider, it's apples. And then you add yeast, and that's how you start fermentation. Mm-hmm. And after that, you kind of let it sit for 7 to 10 days, and then you let it age anywhere from 3 months to a year. So it's very much similar like that. Beer, on the other hand, is brewed with barley and hops, and so that's different.
All right. We're talking about cider with Chow Tu on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And so it's like really simple, though.
It's really simple, right?
Yeah, you can make this at home.
You can make it at home. Yeah, you can make it with any kind of apples. Nine Pin Cider Works, they like to use Macintosh apples in their blends, but it's really up to the cider maker.
Well, I'm going to have to test the fruits of your labors. You brought back some Nine Pin. This is Cider Works hard cider.
Ooh. Yeah. Make fresh.
I wish I had enough for everybody. It's fresh cut. Ooh.
So it's got that. Little fizz, kind of like Prosecco.
Yeah, I have to taste it.
You have to taste it.
Be fair. I need another test. Wait, I need another one.
So what does it taste like? Does it taste like very crisp, or does it taste...
You know, it's not as... if you think about beer, it doesn't have that hoppy taste, like you say, the beer. Mm-hmm. It's very smooth.
Mm-hmm.
I could see this, you know.
There's a little bit of sourness to it.
A little bit of sourness to it. And they can control whether it's sour or sweet in the process.
So that depends on, like, the fermentation and how long they age it. Whenever they're aging it, they want to make sure that it keeps its flavor and aroma. And so they add things like sulfites, sulfur dioxide, and that keeps everything fresh and it keeps the flavor intact.
I have another hour to go. This is not a good idea. Do they add stuff to it? You know, like you see all these craft things, they add oranges or stuff to it?
Yes, they do. So that, again, depends on the cider maker. But Nine Pin, they do stuff with, like, blueberries, for example. So what they'll do is they'll add blueberries during the fermentation stage. And what happens is the yeast actually consumes the sugar from the blueberry, and the taste is the byproduct of that. So it's not overly sweet. It's actually pretty subtle, and it's really good.
And it will take you a whole year to make it, right? You can't go out now where all the apple picking is.
No, yeah. So the apple season basically just ended. Apple picking season is over. But those apples will last for a long time, and you'll have to age cider. Mm. So it'll take up to around a year.
Is this having a comeback? I've seen commercials now on TV for hard cider. You never saw them before.
Yeah. So, I mean, cider making has been around for a while, especially in Europe, but it's getting a resurgence right now. It's partly because of the gluten-free kind of movement, because cider is gluten-free because of the apples.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also because of craft beer being really popular now, and so that's trained people to kind of look for new kinds of drinks, and cider is definitely one of them.
Mm-hmm. You could also make apple vinegar from apple juice, right?
You could, and that's kind of like the process of aging that you want to prevent it from becoming apple vinegar.
You don't want it to.
Be nice and crisp cider, but so you'll add in like sulfur dioxide and sulfites, and that will help prevent it from becoming apple vinegar.
So what was the most wonderful thing about your visit?
Seeing just like the scale at which they work. So Nine Pins say they process 70,000 pounds of apples each week. Yes, each week during the big push. And that's about 5,000 gallons of cider. They're going to make around 100,000 gallons of cider this year. So the scale at which this is happening is great. And
so they have to keep the apples because apples, you know, have to, if they're going to do it all year, they have to keep them around.
Mm-hmm.
How do they store them? They keep
them
fresh?
We also visited an orchard nearby, some Mascot Orchards, and they are the ones that keep all these apples. I mean, it's a huge warehouse as well, and it's like sky high boxes of apples. And so they keep them there, and over time they'll come back over to Nine Pin and they'll press the juice and, yeah, they'll make cider with it.
Wow. Wow. Okay. I'm going to finish my cider. Thank you, Chow.
Yeah, thank you.
You can read Chow's article and watch a video of a tour if you want to see the inside of Nine Pin Cidery. It's on our website at sciencefriday.com/cider. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Taliata. Too much apple cider, I think. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our SciArts producer, Annie Minoff. Luke Graskin, our video producer. Production assistant, Becky Fogel. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman, our engineer at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. And we're officially issuing a weekend challenge. Write this down. How much did you learn from last week's show? Remember last week's show? Take the Week After Science Friday quiz at sciencefriday.com/quiz to show off your smarts and let us know how you did. That's how much do you remember from last week's show? That's the Week After Science Friday quiz, sciencefriday.com/quiz. Show off your smarts. And always we'll be tweeting or on Facebook. If you like us on Facebook and tweet us all week at SciFry. If you're taking off for the holidays, have a good one. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.